Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Salt Roads, How Fish Made a Culture, by John Goodlad. Narrated by Neil McFarlane. Prologue. Pitch dark. It was dark. Not just difficult to see in the dark, but impossible to see in the dark. The kind of complete blackness that can only be found inside a room with no windows. But this was no darkened room. This was midnight in the middle of the North Atlantic, in a hurricane. It was utterly chaotic. Everything was moving around, violently and randomly. The old wooden smack, the telegraph, first fell over to one side and then quickly rolled to the other, before plunging headfirst into a black void that seemed capable of swallowing her. The deck was awash with seawater, as one wave after another crashed on board with a weight that made the boat shudder. And, as if there was not enough water on deck, torrential rain was being driven horizontally by the extreme southwesterly wind. It would have been bad enough, thought James Smith, who was the skipper, if there had even been the slightest visibility. Some idea of where the next towering wave was coming from would have provided a brief warning of sorts. As it was, the telegraph was being bombarded by breaking seas in total darkness. She was no longer moving through the sea, her sails having been ripped to shreds by the hurricane 5 hours ago, just as darkness had come down. At around the same time, what little light that came from the navigation lamps had been extinguished when they were torn from their mountings by a wall of water sweeping the deck. Total unseeing darkness is unusual at sea. There is usually some moonlight. But tonight there was no moon, and it occurred to James that it really was as dark as pitch tar. He hated the darkness, and he longed to see a glimpse of moonlight, although he knew that would not happen until the storm passed. James also knew that darkness was not his problem tonight. His crew were at the mercy of a weather event worse than anything he had ever seen before. The ability of the smack to cope had been seriously compromised when her sails had been torn. If a small area of sail was capturing the wind, the telegraph was able to move ahead, and was capable of being steered. The wind in the sail also heeled her over, which provided some stability against the random seas. But, with shredded sails, the smack lost her momentum and could no longer be controlled. The two tall masts, now devoid of sail, acted as top-heavy weights, making the boat roll even more erratically. 1 minute the port rail was several feet under the water, the next the starboard rail was submerged, as she wallowed helplessly in the storm. The crew on deck were exhausted, cold and soaked through with seawater and driving rain. Apart from a few ship's biscuits, no one had eaten anything for more than a day. They all knew how serious things were, although no one wanted to be the first to say so. Even if they had, time had long passed when their shouting voices could have been heard above the roar of the wind and the thunder of the waves pounding the deck. In his time as a fisherman, James had often contrasted being at sea in heavy weather with the gentle greenness of the family croft back home. A greater contrast could not be imagined, but he liked both. When at home, he yearned to be back at sea, but tonight, as towering seas rose out of the pitch-black night sky and as the wind screamed all around, James wished as never before that he was back at Pund, the small croft where he grew up. It is a magical place, nestling right by the shore on the west side of a narrow ridge of land known as White Ness. All the crofts at White Ness are on the east side of the ridge, except for Pund, which sits by itself facing west. A narrow, almost enclosed finger of sea called Strom Vaux runs north from the croft. Unlike most of Shetland's exposed coastline, the sea in this Vaux never gets rough. This was the secluded, sheltered, and idyllic place where the Smith family were raised. All the Pund children had to do their share of work on the croft, tending to the animals and looking after the limited crops that were grown. But James's real interest was in boats and the sea. Below the croft house is a stone beach, perfect for hauling small boats up and down. Every spare minute that he had was spent with his four brothers in the family boat, in the shelter of Strom Vaux, before gradually venturing into more open waters when he was older. As soon as he left school, he became a fisherman, as did his four brothers. Like many men from White Ness, they found berths on board the growing fleet of cod smacks. His oldest brother, John Smith, became skipper of the Anaconda at a young age. As the next oldest, James wanted to emulate his brother's success. He was ambitious. The four brothers, close in age, were regularly competing, but for James, there was something more that drove him. Always wanting to be the best, he was strong-willed, sharp-witted, and a good seaman. He was confident that he could be as good a smack skipper as his brother, better, in fact. This ambition and determination, while central to his character, did not always define him. He could be easygoing, and he had a sense of humour. Before he spoke, the relaxed twinkle in his light blue eyes would often preface a funny remark, sometimes at his own expense. Whenever he needed to concentrate on a task at hand, however, his demeanour would suddenly change, as his eyes became intensely focused. Always precise in his approach, whether it was catching a sheep on the croft or setting a course on his smack, everyone knew they could rely on him. His blue eyes and high cheekbones were typical of all the Smiths from Pund, as was his dark hair. James had that heady mix of Scandinavian and Scottish genes that characterises so many Shetland families. After several years sailing as a fisherman on board different smacks, he managed to get a job as a mate for a couple of years. In 1877, when he was 27 years old, he got the break he was looking for. One of the island's most successful cod merchants, Joseph Leask, offered him the job of skippering the Telegraph. She was one of the company's largest smacks, carrying a crew of 14. James had been keen to prove himself, and he went on to land a bumper catch of cod that year, making her one of the best fished boats in the fleet. Joseph Leask was happy. His cod smack was making money, confirming that his choice of the young skipper had been a good one. It was now early September 1878, and James had almost finished his second year in command of the Telegraph. They were fishing off northeast Iceland on their last trip of the year. The first two trips had been successful, and he once again had a good catch of cod salted down in the hold. Preparations were being made to set sail for home when word came that another Shetland smack, the Gondola, had dragged her anchor and was stranded on a beach. All the crew were safe, but it looked as if the smack would be a total loss. The decision was taken to leave the skipper and two deckhands in Iceland until the owners decided what to do with the wreck, but eight crew members asked if they could get back home with the Telegraph. James readily agreed. Taking extra food and fresh water on board, they were intending to leave Iceland along with two other smacks owned by Joseph Leask, the Novice and the Destiny. The smacks owned by the same owner generally fished alongside each other and, if possible, always tried to make the passage home together. As the crew made ready for their long voyage, the wind had started to pick up, and James wondered if the weather was set to deteriorate. There were no weather forecasts, so it was the skipper's observation and experience that determined if a vessel would sail. Black clouds were starting to form in the southwest, a sure sign of worsening weather. But he was torn between this concern and the desire of everyone to leave as soon as possible. At the end of a long trip, there was always a lot of pressure on a skipper to get home. The crew were tired, and they had all had enough of living and working in a cramped, damp boat for weeks on end. To delay sailing would be unpopular, to say the least, and the skippers of the two other smacks had already told James that they were going to head for home. To stay in Iceland until the weather was more settled, when the other company smacks had left, would be unthinkable. So he took the only decision that appeared open to him. They would sail for Shetland as well. At least he had plenty of crew, he thought, should he need more men on watch. With the eight from the Gondola, there was now a total of 22 men on board. The crew of the Telegraph had worked well together during the season, catching a lot of cod. So everyone was looking forward to a decent pay at the end of this trip. There had, however, been one last-minute change to the crew. Just before leaving home, the second mate had turned ill. One of the skipper's younger brothers, Henry, was taken on as his replacement. He was only 24 years old. The distant water smacks were generally skippered and crewed by young men, and the Telegraph was no exception. Most of the crew were teenagers, and only one was married. The Smith brothers, James and Henry, were the oldest on board. When the three smacks left Iceland on the morning of Saturday the 14th of September, a strong wind from the southwest was already blowing. As some of his earlier concerns about the weather returned, James reminded himself that they had all sailed through worse many times before. The sails were fully reefed, a method of reducing the sail area, essential in strong winds, and everything on deck was tied down and made secure in preparation for a rough passage. As night came down, the Telegraph plunged through an increasingly angry sea. When daylight broke the next morning, it was clear that conditions had deteriorated. The wind had increased during the night and had now reached storm force, with the seas becoming ever more threatening. Visibility was so poor that the Destiny and Novice could no longer be seen. Heavy rain and endless spray meant that the men on deck were constantly soaked through. As one watch replaced another, the cramped conditions below deck soon became a chaotic scene of discarded wet clothing as the worn-out crew tried to get some rest in the damp berths. Rest might have been possible, but sleep was out of the question. As the salt water slowly dried on their faces, turning them white, the teenage crew looked like terrified old men. There was no abatement as the day wore on. The smack dived violently into the depths of the troughs between the waves before slowly managing to lift her bow up on the next wave. She was sitting so heavy in the water, with her large cargo of salt cod, that it sometimes felt as if she did not have enough buoyancy to defy the gravitational pull of the ocean. The Robert Kirkwood, one of the smacks belonging to another fishing company, was sighted in the distance. While it may have been of some comfort to both crews to know that another smack was at hand, this comfort was illusory, as there was nothing any one vessel could do to help another in such terrible conditions. With darkness falling on the second night, it was plain that both smacks were now at the mercy of a hurricane, the like of which neither skipper had seen before. By this time, they were well south of Iceland, and, with no shelter near at hand, they had no alternative but to keep going until the weather improved. The storm was at its fiercest around midnight. Although a gale was still blowing when dawn came, the worst had passed. The skipper of the Robert Kirkwood saw no sign of the Telegraph that morning, but did not think anything of it. Just as the two smacks had come in sight of each other the day before, so two smacks could easily lose sight of each other during the night. As the weather slowly improved, the crew of the Robert Kirkwood were able to raise more sail and begin to make better speed on their way back to Shetland. When they arrived in Scalloway, they were surprised that there was no sign of the Telegraph. The other two smacks belonging to Joseph Leask, which had left Iceland at the same time, had made it back safely, although both had suffered damage to their bulwarks and rigging. As the crews of the smacks went about their work that day, they found themselves regularly looking westward, willing the Telegraph to appear among the isles at the entrance to the harbour. Despite the ferocity of the storm, they reassured themselves that James Smith was an able skipper, with a good crew, and a large smack. But she never came that day, nor the day after. As time went on, worry was replaced by concern, before anxiety finally took over. It was an agonizing time for everyone, but none more so than for the families of the crew. Hope is difficult to extinguish. Sometimes it is all that people have left. But as each day passed, the reality of the situation eventually stole what little hope remained. The families faced the appalling realization that none of their men were ever going to come home. It was a double tragedy. The crews of two smacks had been lost. There was much speculation as to what might have happened. Other smaller smacks had survived the severe storm, so something serious must have overcome the telegraph during that second night at sea. With her torn sails, she was at the mercy of whatever the North Atlantic could throw at her. It is likely that an exceptionally powerful wave tore off the hatches to the fishhold or accommodation, with the next breaking wave flooding the vessel. She would have immediately developed a list with a catastrophic loss of stability. Until this time, the crew would have hoped that, once the hurricane had passed, they would make safe passage home. When she started to flood, this hope would have been replaced in the blink of an eye with the horrific fact that they were sinking. For these few last confused minutes before she went down, every crew member would have had his private terror. A dread of drowning, perhaps, maybe a longing for the family he would never see again, or even wishing that this nightmare would all end quickly. Some might have prayed, others may have cried. It would have been a desperate scene. The Smith brothers were on deck together as she started to flood. Looking at James, Henry recalled how, as a child, he had always looked to his older brother to sort out problems and find solutions. For James, the aching realization that he would never see Pund again was punctuated, not for the first time, with bitter regret at his decision to leave Iceland when he had harboured his private doubts about the weather. The loss of the telegraph was not an exception. Many smacks were lost at sea as they sailed around the North Atlantic in search of cod. It was a time of one tragedy after another for many fishermen and their families. Despite these losses, the drive to catch cod never lessened. There was money to be made, and it was all the result of an insatiable demand for salt cod in Spain. Why had salt fish become so important? Chapter 1. The Dutch and the Basques. Sitting at the desk in my office, I am holding a fillet of dried salt cod. It feels strange, as if I am handling a delicate historical artifact. There is a strong smell of slightly rotten fish, but it isn't decayed in any way. It just has that very strong, pungent smell that all cured protein does. This is a smell that we no longer recognise, thanks to the odourless, plastic-covered food we pluck from supermarket shelves. The fillet is stiff, but not heavy, since most of the moisture has been removed during the drying process. It reminds me of a piece of balsa wood, making the same kind of wooden noise when I gently knock it on my desk. A dusting of salt crystals falls and sparkles white, like winter morning frost in the light that is streaming through the window. This is only a small proportion of the salt, most of it remaining attached to both sides of the fish, forming a crust that has the texture of sandpaper. At last, I decide to find out what it tastes like, tearing a bit away with my teeth. Not surprisingly, the sensation is mostly of salt and only slightly of fish, a flavour that does not change during the long chewing process. This is no subtle eating experience. It is the taste of well-preserved protein. Amid all the electronic equipment spread around the desk, my fillet of salt cod seems strange and not of our world anymore. It only has historical relevance in the same way as an Iron Age nail might have. And yet, confined to home because of the pandemic, it occurs to me that I cannot eat any of my electronics. In contrast, a piece of salt fish is a meal, and if I had enough stored away, it could keep my family alive for a long time. Most people today have never eaten salt fish. Its hard texture, rotten smell, and salty taste does not appeal to our modern palate. So used have we become to pasta, blueberries, and avocado that it is hard to believe that salt fish was once an essential part of the weekly diet for most people. Before food could be preserved by freezing, fresh protein could only be eaten for a short time after an animal was killed. Unless the meat and fish could be cured in some way, it would be lost, as decay rendered it inedible and eventually dangerous to eat. In medieval societies, where hunger was common and famine not unknown, the rotting of scarce food was a disaster that had to be avoided at all costs. For most people, life was precarious, and survival during the winter months depended on how much food it had been possible to preserve. All surplus protein had to be cured. There were two main methods, drying or salting, or some combination of both. Salt fish therefore became an important part of the medieval insurance policy against hunger. Amongst the many kinds of salt fish, two species came to dominate the diet of Europeans before the age of freezing. In northern Europe, herring was king, while cod became the queen of the Mediterranean. To successfully cure fish is not easy, and the techniques were first discovered by two of Europe's great seafaring nations, the Dutch with herring and the Basques with cod. They both used their newly acquired expertise to build up huge fishing and trading enterprises that fed much of Europe. Herring are a shoaling species that often swim very close to shore, which means that very large quantities can be caught even when using the most primitive of nets. It is also an exceptionally oily fish that deteriorates very quickly. This combination of large catches and rapid spoilage meant that an effective preservation technique was vital in order to make best use of the fish. In far too many cases, the largest proportion of a bumper catch would have to be used for fertilizer once everyone in the locality had eaten all the fresh herring that they could. Many people had tried salting herring, but it was a Dutchman, Willem Boykels, who is credited with perfecting the technique in the late 15th century. Previous attempts to preserve herring had involved taking out all the fish intestines before adding salt. This seemed the obvious thing to do, as fish start spoiling in the gut before spreading to the flesh. It was therefore somewhat counterintuitive that Boykels only took out some of the internal organs, leaving the liver and pancreas in the gut cavity. By doing so, he discovered that the salted herring tasted much better and, crucially, could be kept for up to a year. It is now known that the liver and pancreas release important enzymes that are essential to the curing process. Having discovered the secret of preserving herring, the Dutch saw a business opportunity and wondered how they could best realize the potential of catching and salting herring. The answer was the herring bus, a two-masted decked boat that was able to venture far out into the North Sea, where it was possible to catch larger quantities of herring in drift nets that were set each night. It was a very wide vessel with plenty of space below decks for gutting and salting the herring. A bus would remain at sea, catching and processing, until its hold was full of barrels of salt herring. This could often take months. By the early 16th century, a fleet of more than 1,000 buses fished throughout the North Sea, with the fishing grounds east of Shetland being particularly important during July and August. Once they had fully supplied their domestic market, the Dutch looked eastwards, towards Germany, Poland, and Russia, where there was a huge demand for cured fish. Before long, a barrel of salt herring became an essential source of protein for most households in Eastern Europe during the long cold winters that swept in from Siberia. The Dutch had a monopoly of the salt herring trade for a long time. Huge profits were made, and this partly accounted for the period of prosperity associated with the Dutch Golden Age. Shetlanders used to say that the building of Amsterdam was financed by the catching of herring 20 miles east of Lerwick. Undoubtedly an exaggeration, but, like all hyperbole, there may have been a kernel of truth buried somewhere. By the early 19th century, the Dutch monopoly was being challenged by Scotland and Norway. These two newcomers copied the Dutch model, apart from one very important difference. Instead of curing the herring on board, the Scottish and Norwegian fleets landed their catch to curing yards, where thousands of women gutted and packed the herring into barrels. This made sense as they were fishing their own herring stocks near the coast. For the Dutch, who sent their buses to the other end of the North Sea, onshore curing was never a possibility. Most of the salt herring from Scotland and Norway was also exported to Eastern Europe. In the period before the outbreak of the First World War, It is estimated that upwards of 2 million barrels were shipped every year from Scotland to Baltic ports. An extensive transport network was developed from these ports to thousands of small villages and towns throughout Germany, Poland, and Russia. The distances involved were vast, particularly in the Russian steppe. Before the age of railroads, salt herring could only be transported if there was snow, the barrels being carried on horse-drawn sleighs. In those years when the snows came late, this distribution network collapsed. For as long as these so-called green winters lasted, barrels of salt herring were stuck in the Baltic ports, while the rural population, many miles from the sea, went hungry. Herring was not only eaten in Eastern Europe, it was also a popular food throughout the north of Europe. Eaten several times a week, it became an integral part of the culture and diet of many countries. In Scandinavia, salt herring is used to make surseald, a type of pickled herring that is eaten raw. It is still popular, with the surseald option remaining part of the breakfast buffet in most Scandinavian hotels. In the Netherlands, while many types of preserved herring are eaten, the favourite is matjes. This is a herring that is very fat and has only been cured in salt for a few days. The word matje comes from the Dutch word for virgin, maagd, presumably named since these are the young herring caught at the beginning of the summer. Like surseald, matjes are eaten raw. Preparation is very simple. The head, guts and spine are removed, leaving two herring fillets still joined by the tail. If you are Dutch, there is only one way to eat this. You hold the fish firmly by the tail, tilt your head back, and slowly lower the raw fillets into your mouth. Two important things to remember: don't eat the tail, and finish with a long, cool beer. This very Dutch custom can still be seen at the many matje festivals throughout the Netherlands every June. In Scotland, the culinary tradition was much more basic, with salt herring being boiled, with the water being changed several times to remove most of the salt, and then eaten with potatoes. A staple meal at one time around the Scottish coast. We had salt herring for dinner every Saturday when I was a boy, a custom that was common in the fishing village where I grew up. Salt herring was a cheap source of protein that was eaten extensively throughout Scotland during the 19th century. Aberdeen University students, who came from the coastal towns and villages around the Scottish north coast, took a barrel of salt herring with them at the start of each term. Since salt herring was inexpensive, buying a barrel made a lot of sense for those families who were already financially stretched to cover the cost of university fees and lodgings. Herring is still the most popular fish eaten in Eastern Europe. It is now rarely salted, being sold as frozen or canned instead. The days of a barrel of salt herring in the home of peasants have long gone. But centuries of eating salt herring have left a cultural imprint, and it is still eaten in the most unexpected of places, including Israel. Most Jews living in Poland and Russia up until the First World War stayed in the almost exclusive Jewish villages called shtetls, which were very traditional communities and highly orthodox when it came to matters of faith. Like most of Eastern Europe at the time, salt herring had become an indispensable part of their diet, with a variety of pickled herring dishes being served at the many Jewish festivals. Herring came to feature heavily in the weekly pre-Sabbath dinner every Friday night. The shtetls have now disappeared, but the legacy of Jewish pickled herring continues in Israel. Although herring is not a fish that was ever eaten in the Middle East, some Israeli companies now import frozen herring, which they then salt to produce the pickled herring dishes for those recent immigrants from Russia who have taken their salt herring cuisine with them. Turning south, salt cod became the staple of the Mediterranean diet. Cod is a very different fish from herring. It lives longer and grows much larger. It is said that a cod will eat any fish that is smaller than itself, something that can be attested by anyone who has gutted a cod and seen the eclectic range of species in its stomach. This penchant for eating anything is entirely different from herring, which eats nothing but plankton. The flesh of a cod is virtually fat-free. All the fat needed by cod is contained within the liver, unlike...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?